Chapter 92. Mary kept her countenance pretty well over the next few days, during which the house was turned upside down by the preparations for Mrs. Bennet's hasty departure. She did not crumple when her mother climbed into her carriage, her whole person stiff with affront, refusing to make so much as a farewell nod to her disobedient daughter as she drove away. Later, Mary was still tolerably in control of herself when she finally plucked up the courage to read Mr. Ryder's letter. It was a gentlemanly epistle, containing neither recrimination nor offence. Only one line in it caused her a moment's pause. "Had you taken me as I am, I have no doubt I should eventually have become the man I ought to be. For that, I am sorry." She bit her lip at that, but there was no point in torturing herself anew. She had made her choice, taken her gamble, and now she must live with the consequences. It was not until life returned to its regular rhythm that she really began to suffer. Whilst there had been crisis and urgency and drama, she had sustained herself tolerably well, but now there was nothing but the everyday and the ordinary to greet her when she woke. Her spirits plummeted. She could not work, could not settle to her books. She had no energy to read to the children. She had consigned herself to an existence whose main, whose only purpose was waiting, and that, she discovered, ate away at her until she could barely force herself to leave her room. At night she did not sleep, but stared into the darkness, when doubts and fears crowded in upon her. Her mother was right. She was a stupid fool. She had lost the one man who would have made her truly happy. There was no reason to think he would appear now, and she had rejected his friend, who might have rescued her from a future she had feared for as long as she could remember. She would become that most despised of creatures, an old maid. And this was how it would feel, on and on and on, forever, until she was too old or too sad to care. As she walked past Mary's door on her way to bed, Mrs. Gardiner often heard her crying. She stood outside, wondering if she should go in. But what comfort could she offer? She asked her husband whether she should write again to Mrs. Haywood or try to discover where Tom Haywood was walking. Mr. Gardiner thought not. It was a very difficult business all around. When the law courts opened again in the autumn, Tom must return to his work. Then, perhaps, Mr. Gardiner might try to speak to him, but now it was best not to interfere. No good would come of it. The young people must be left to resolve it for themselves. At first, her aunt was relieved when Mary was not to be found in tears quite so often, but soon she was not sure whether her dry-eyed misery was much to be preferred. In the absence of any other useful tasks with which to occupy her time, Mrs. Gardiner encouraged Mary to take as much exercise as possible. Walking, she thought, must be good for her, or at least could do no harm. And each morning she urged Mary to take an airing, in the hope that she might return a little less miserable. Mary did not protest. What else had she to do? And it was on one of these aimless walks that she felt someone fall into step beside her. Looking around, she was astonished to discover her new companion was none other than Caroline Bingley, the very last person likely to be found striding so confidently along such an unfashionable city street.
"Good morning, Miss Bennet. I have been looking for you. Your aunt was kind enough to suggest where I might find you, since you were not at home when I called."
Her careful politeness gave no hint of the hostility of their previous encounters, but Mary was not deceived into thinking her appearance boded well. "If I had known you planned to visit us, I would have ensured I was there to receive you."
"But then I would have missed the pleasure of walking through such a very interesting district," replied Miss Bingley sweetly. "It is not a part of town with which I am at all familiar. It positively bustles, does it not?"
Mary's heart was racing, and she knew she must show no sign of weakness or hesitation in Miss Bingley's presence. She gathered up all her courage and smiled back at her with equal insincerity.
Since you have found me, I am at your disposal. Should you like to come back to Gracechurch Street, where we could have some tea?
Well, that would be charming,
declared Miss Bingley, her tone implying that it would be nothing of the kind.
But the children seemed in a particularly boisterous mood this morning. The ambience wasn't entirely conducive to the quiet conversation I'd hoped to have with you.
She touched the collar of her perfectly cut jacket, as if to brush away any specks of city dirt which had had the temerity to attach themselves to it.
I passed a respectable-looking pastry shop a few steps back. It appears they have private rooms upstairs for ladies. I suggest we take ourselves there instead.
They walked in silence to the very shop where Mary had been taken by Mr. Ryder in what now seemed a lifetime ago. Miss Bingley swept into its precincts, commanded the best table on the first floor, and ordered China tea, sliced lemon, and a plate of macaroons. It is not exactly Gunter's. One could hardly expect that so far from the West End, but I think it will serve our purposes, murmured Miss Bingley, dismissing the waiter and pouring out the tea herself. Mary had decided to say nothing until she had some idea of Miss Bingley's intention in bringing her there. She did not have long to wait.
I don't think there is anything to be gained in making idle conversation, Miss Bennet, so I will come to the point directly.
She wiped her mouth delicately with a napkin.
I understand that Mr. Ryder came to visit you not long ago. I should be grateful to know what he spoke of whilst he was there.
Mary looked up, nonplussed. She had not expected such a direct approach. She was surprised to find her apprehension falling away, replaced by resentment that Miss Bingley should see fit to question her in such a manner. It was a private matter. It seems odd you should ask about it. Miss Bingley inclined her head, as if to indicate that, although she had heard the displeasure in Mary's voice, she did not choose to acknowledge it.
He mentioned to me that he saw you.
Then you should ask him about what was said.
But I am asking you.
I'm not sure with what aim.
Was there a declaration of some kind?
At this, Mary finally awoke from the miserable lethargy which had engulfed her so long. Who was this woman to interrogate her in this way? What right did she have to demand answers from her? All the humiliation and misery of the last months suddenly turned into a kind of rage. She would not be treated like this. She had had enough and would no longer bear it. That is an extraordinary question. I cannot imagine why you think you have the right to ask it.
That was the impression Mr. Ryder gave me.
I am amazed he felt able to discuss our conversation with one whom it did not concern. Did he volunteer this information freely, or did you demand it of him? Mary was pleased to see Miss Bingley's composure waver a little.
I saw he was upset. When I asked why, he seemed happy enough to tell me. He is not a man who hides his feelings from himself or others. He implied you had not given him reason to hope.
If you have had that from him, I do not see why you require anything further from me.
Because I wish to understand from you directly if it is true, or whether it is just a ploy to whet his interest, to make him even more eager to have you. After all, that was a ruse that worked very well for your sister. Darcy never wanted her more than when she was clever enough to refuse him.
Mary was really angry now, but determined not to show it. Miss Bingley should not have the satisfaction of knowing she had provoked her. That is as ignorant as it is insulting, she replied deliberately. Elizabeth would never trifle knowingly with the affections of a decent man. No more would I. Miss Bingley leant across the table, her face taut with bitterness.
Yes, you Bennets all talk a fine game, but in practice you're as hard-headed as the most consummate husband-hunters. You have a remarkable record of reeling in the men you want and then looking around as if it was all an amazing accident.
Nothing to do with you at all. Just love finding a way. I've seen it happen twice in front of my eyes, so please don't play the innocent with me.
As I do not love Mr. Ryder, it would make no sense for me to marry him. Miss Bingley laughed out loud.
Oh, come, Miss Bennet, we are not children. When you think of the alternative, marrying a man one does not love may be the most rational decision a woman can make. Do not pretend you haven't considered it, especially now that Ryder is to be so rich. I cannot believe you were unaffected by that piece of news.
For the first time, Mary was genuinely surprised by Miss Bingley's words. To give herself something to do whilst she marshalled her thoughts, she took the napkin off her lap, folded it carefully, and placed it on her plate. I have no idea what you mean.
Please don't treat me as a fool.
I do not know what you are talking about. If you will not enlighten me, I do not see how we can continue this conversation. Mary held Miss Bingley's gaze, determined not to be the one who looked away. In the end, it was Miss Bingley who flinched, accepting that she would learn no more of Mary's true intentions without disclosing what she knew. She had had the story from Mr. Ryder himself. He told her that shortly before their trip to the lakes, he had been called to Kent to attend Lady Catherine de Bourgh at Rosings. There he had found his relative so beside herself with fury and frustration that it had taken some time for him to understand the cause of her anger. A whole day passed before the terrible truth was revealed to him in all its horror and shame. Her ladyship's daughter, Miss Anne de Bourgh, was engaged to be married to her doctor.
You might think such a thing impossible, Mr. Ryder. It should be impossible. If there were any gratitude and obedience in this world, it must be impossible. But I regret to tell you that it is not.
The affair, it appeared, had been going on under Lady Catherine's unseeing eyes for some time.
For years, Mr. Ryder. Years.
The silent couple concealing their affections until Miss de Bourgh reached her majority.
Think of the deceit, the flouting of my authority.
Now that she was 21, however, Miss de Bourgh was free to contract a marriage with whomever she chose, however distressing her intentions were to her mother.
This is how I am repaid for a lifetime's care and trouble. This is how I'm defied and humiliated.
Lady Catherine now demanded that Mr. Ryder seek to achieve what her own efforts had failed to do and bring her daughter to her senses. He doubted very much whether his endeavours would have any more success than her ladyship's, and he was quickly proved right. His attempts to make Miss de Bourgh consider, if not her own position, then what she owed to her mother, fell on very stony ground indeed. It was quickly evident that she had no sympathy at all for a parent who she considered had always bullied and belittled her, and that she could not wait to begin a new life at as great a distance away from her as possible. It was an additional blow to Lady Catherine to discover, so late in their dealings with each other, that her daughter's will was quite as strong as her own, and not to be deflected by either threat or inducement. When it was certain Mr. Ryder could do no good, there was nothing left for the beleaguered Lady Catherine to do but apply to her nephew for his help. Only in such pressing circumstances was she reluctantly prepared to acknowledge Mr. Darcy's position as the titular head of the family. But when the Darcys arrived at Rosings, she began to regret the decision to invite them. Neither her nephew nor his wife seemed inclined to pursue the matter with the harshness she thought appropriate. Mrs. Darcy, she suspected of harbouring some sympathy for her daughter's situation, having come upon them more than once closeted in conversations she could not but regard as disloyal, and she did not doubt Mrs. Darcy's opinions were reflected in her husband's ultimate conclusions as to the best way to proceed. Having interviewed the doctor, Mr. Darcy declared himself satisfied that he was no fortune hunter, but a respectable man with a genuine affection for Miss de Bourgh. That lady was as determined to marry him as he was to marry her, and it was therefore difficult, and probably unprofitable, to imagine how or even why they should be prevented from doing so. Miss Bingley took a sip of her tea. Mary sat in silence until she was ready to continue. Mr. Darcy, it appeared, had advised Lady Catherine to reconcile herself, with what good grace she could muster, to a union that was likely to take place, whatever she thought of it, and to do what she could to salvage some fond feelings in her daughter by not appearing vindictive. Lady Catherine paid not the slightest attention to this latter advice, but she was finally persuaded to agree to the marriage itself, once Mr. Berg made it clear she was quite prepared to elope with her doctor if her mother refused to countenance more usual arrangements. Lady Catherine laid down two conditions. The marriage should take place as privately as possible, with all who knew of it agreeing to say nothing about what had transpired. And the happy couple should immediately afterwards go abroad and stay there, on as prolonged a honeymoon as was possible. When these requests were agreed to, they were married, by private license, in the drawing-room at Rosings.
"I believe," observed Miss Bingley, "it was your old friend Mr. Collins who did the honours. He was always ready to do anything in his power to oblige her ladyship, and Mr. Darcy made all the arrangements, ensuring that, for the moment at least, it has attracted no public attention nor any breath of scandal, rather as he did for your sister Lydia, as I recall."
Describing the misfortunes of others had quite restored Miss Bingley's self-assurance, and she poured herself more tea with all the calmness in the world. Mr. Ryder, she continued, had attended the wedding, as had Mr. and Mrs. Darcy, although Lady Catherine had not lowered herself by doing so. She had been compelled to accept the fact of her daughter's choice, but had resolved never to forgive her for it. And whilst Mr. Berg was exchanging her vows, her mother was consulting lawyers, determined to extract, via the law, the revenge she had not been able to elicit by any other means. By the time the new husband and wife were on board the boat to Calais, Lady Catherine had decided exactly what was to be done. The properties bequeathed to Mr. Berg by the terms of her father's will could not be withheld from her, except by ingenious legal challenges, which were certain to be protracted and whose outcome must be unknown. But Lady Catherine's own money remained hers to dispose of as she wished, and she was absolutely determined it should not be bestowed upon such a wicked, ungrateful child as her daughter had revealed herself to be.
"So," concluded Miss Bingley, "to everyone's surprise, including his own, she made Mr. Ryder her heir. Mr. Darcy and his family she considered wealthy enough already, and I think she had a particular disinclination to add to the riches your sister already enjoys. There being no other near relation, Mr. Ryder was the lucky man. He will not be as wealthy as Mr. Darcy, but he will certainly be what is called comfortable. Whoever marries him will be assured of a very agreeable situation."
For a moment, Mary sat stupefied. It was some time before she spoke. "I am surprised no word of this story has yet found its way to Gracechurch Street, but I do not see why you think it should affect my feelings for Mr. Ryder. If I did not encourage his advances before I was aware of his good fortune, you cannot think I would change my mind when I was told of it." Miss Bingley smiled her little smile. "I think it is entirely to Mr. Ryder's credit that he did not mention it to me himself," continued Mary. "A more foolish man, certainly a less honourable one, might have thought it would make a difference, and with some women it might well do so."
"That is a strike at me, I imagine," said Miss Bingley, "but I do not feel it. I cannot be lectured by a Bennet on the relationship between love and money and be hurt by it. It is impossible for me to take your protestations at face value when I consider your sister's histories or what your mother would be likely to advise were you to confide in her."
Mary picked up her cup and drank what remained of her tea. She did not hurry as she stood up, plucked her coat from the hook on the wall, and began to put it on. "You have insulted me and my family in every possible way," she said quietly. There is really nothing more to be said between us. Now Miss Bingley rose, pushing her chair to the wall with such force that it scraped along the floor.
Can you promise me you will not marry Mr. Ryder? That your refusal was not mere strategy on your part?
I make no promise. I give you no undertaking. I owe you nothing at all.
But I know you don't want him. It's the friend for whom you have such a tendresse, isn't it? The boring lawyer. Does he know how you feel? Perhaps someone should enlighten him.
The venom in Miss Bingley's voice was unmistakable, but Mary was surprised to discover herself unaffected by it. With an evenness she did not think she possessed, Mary was quite calm as she tied the ribbons under her hat. For a long time, I was frightened of you, just as you intended me to be. But your power over me is finished now. I see you for what you are, a bitter, angry spirit, so eaten up with unhappiness that you can do nothing but make other people as miserable as yourself. If I was a better woman, I should pity you. Instead, I am merely grateful that you cannot touch me any more, because I will not allow it. Mary straightened her hair and picked up her things, with as much equanimity as if she had been bidding Miss Bingley a polite farewell. If you wish to make trouble, you will do so, whatever I say. But I will not live in fear of it, and am therefore quite prepared to tell you what you seem so desperate to know. Yes, I do love Mr. Hayward. He is the only man who I think would ever make me happy. No, I have no wish to marry Mr. Ryder. That is the truth. You may do with it what you will. She turned and left the room, closing the door quietly after herself and walking down the stairs, head held high. It was only when she reached the street that she trembled a little with shock, but she mastered herself. She was not ashamed of how she had conducted herself or of what she had said. She did not look up once at the great bay window of the pastry shop, behind which she knew Miss Bingley still sat, but walked steadily into Leadenhall Market, heading towards Gracechurch Street and home. Chapter 93. Once back at the gardener's, Mary felt at first as though a great weight had slipped from her shoulders. She had slain the dragon that was Miss Bingley by calling upon hitherto unsuspected reserves of bravery and self-possession. She had spoken her mind and told the truth, and there was relief of a kind in that. She did not allow herself to dwell on the extraordinary story of Mr. Ryder's good fortune, for when she did think of it, it could not help but raise him in her estimation. His declining to mention it suggested a delicacy on his part which was wholly admirable, a desire to be accepted for himself and not for his expectations. That made her think better of him as a man, but it did not encourage her to reconsider his offer. Any doubts that had lingered about whether she had been right to refuse it had been swept away in the tea shop. The strength of her affections had been put to the test, and her bleak declaration to Miss Bingley had summed up the truth of the matter. She loved Mr. Hayward, and only he would make her truly happy. This knowledge, however, was not calculated to bring her any peace. She supposed she must assume whatever affection he had once felt for her was quite obliterated. What else could explain his long-continued silence? But that did not prevent her from thinking about him at all hours of the day and night. She missed him at the dinner table, where his jokes and observations had made her laugh, and in the drawing-room, where she had first heard him talk properly of poetry. Her heart contracted when the children asked where he was, and when he and his pockets full of sweets would return. She no longer wore the dress made from the cotton he had recommended when they first met at Harding and Howell's, but folded it up and put it away. Every knock at the door, every arrival of the post, was a new occasion for pain. She did not know how she would face him when he returned to London, as she knew eventually he must. How would she conduct herself? What would she say? No matter how often she imagined it, she did not know. As the days went by, Mary attempted to impose some discipline on her feelings, telling herself she must find ways not to dwell upon her sadness, to abandon herself to misery was to allow the Miss Bingleys of the world victory over her and to confirm the correctness of all her mother's opinions on the relations between marriage and happiness. In their different ways, Mary understood that neither of these ladies would have been disappointed to learn that she was miserable, and this spurred her into making efforts that she would not otherwise have had the energy or spirits to attempt. Thus, she forced herself to rise early, to have her hair properly dressed, and to keep herself neatly turned out. These seemed minor victories over such a profound sense of loss, but she saw them as essential battles in a campaign she could not afford to lose. If she allowed unhappiness to swallow her up, she might never escape its clutches again. So she dusted off her books, got out pen and paper, and tried to think of a new course of study to engage her mind. She played with the Gardner children, she practiced on the piano once more, and when she went out on her city walks, she pushed herself to explore beyond her usual territories, forcing herself to discover new streets, unfamiliar monuments, and different districts. It was always better, she found, to do something rather than nothing, and thus, for week after week, she occupied herself. It was on exactly such a journey that one afternoon Mary found herself in an area she did not know at all. She had gone beyond St. Paul's and was attempting to find her bearings when she heard the sound of shouting and singing approaching along the street. She shrank into the shelter of a nearby shopfront, resolving to escape inside if the noise proved to indicate trouble. But as it drew nearer, it became clear that it was a very good-natured hullabaloo. She stole cautiously out of her refuge to see what it was, and beheld a large group of young men, cheering and huzzaing as they marched along. On the pavement, an older man stood watching them with the greatest satisfaction, beating time to their singing with his stick. He looked prosperous and respectable enough for a woman alone to speak to him, and Mary decided to risk an approach. "Excuse me, sir, but may I ask you what is going on? Who are the marchers and what are they celebrating?" The gentleman doffed his hat and smiled at her, seemingly pleased to be asked.
"Why, ma'am, they are medical students from Bart's Hospital. They have finished their exams and they are parading in triumph, off to a grand dinner at a tavern to mark their efforts."
He gazed at them indulgently and turned back to Mary.
"I was one of them myself more years ago than I care to admit, and I like to see the old traditions kept up."
"They will be doctors then, sir, as you are now?"
"Yes, if they survive their time on the wards. Usually there is one amongst them who has done better than the rest and is appointed their king for the day. He is distinguished by the wearing of a crown of oak leaves, like the Caesars, you know. Ah, here he is now, right in the midst of them."
He pointed at the crowd, and Mary found herself looking directly at the flushed, happy face of John Sparrow. He was a young man now rather than a great boy, but there was no mistaking his familiar features. The oak-leaf crown had slipped a little and gave him a slightly tipsy look, but beneath his excitement she could see a sharp, intelligent face. His fellows patted him on the back, cheered and joshed him. It was plain he was utterly at home in their company. "He has found his place," thought Mary, deeply moved. "He is happy. I did not injure him so badly that he could not recover his spirit. He will become everything he wished to be, with his brass plate on the door and his carriage outside." She turned away, for she did not wish to catch his eye and ruin the moment. She was part of his past and had no place in his joyous, noisy present. Her face was shining as she bid the older man goodbye. "Thank you so much, sir, for explaining it to me. I am so glad to have seen such a remarkable thing." He tipped his hat to her again as she left, pleased to find that he was not old enough to have lost his appreciation for the smile of a charming young woman. Mary did not know quite why it was, but somehow her encounter with John Sparrow began to soothe her anxious mind. Seeing him so carefree and fulfilled released her from a burden which she had been carrying for so long that she did not appreciate the weight of it until it slid away. If she was not any happier, she felt steadier, more able to contemplate a future in which Mr. Hayward played no part. If she must find her way forward alone, then so be it. Perhaps the life of a single woman need not be as miserable and as humiliating as was universally insisted upon. Perhaps much depended on the circumstances and the woman. After all, Mary thought, she would never be as poor and as desperate as the unfortunate Miss Allen. Her sister's marriages had rescued her from that fate. They would always provide her with a place to live. She should never find herself hurrying up the drives of country houses to teach young ladies the piano, unable to say where she should find her next shilling. She would always have some little space that was hers, and perhaps a room of one's own was all a thinking woman really required. She could read and study. She might even attempt to write something herself. Mrs. Macaulay had shown it might be done. Why should she not follow in those footsteps? It was hardly what Mrs. Bennet would regard as a suitable occupation for her daughter, but then her mother had washed her hands of her. She was free now to think as she wished on such matters. Through all this, Mrs. Gardiner watched her niece, uncertain what to think. She admired Mary's strength of will. She applauded her bravery. She was relieved to see her no longer so hopelessly, desperately miserable. But for all her dry-eyed fortitude, there was something quashed and doused about her that was painful to watch. Resignation was clearly to be preferred to the alternative, but perhaps only just. Chapter 94. Mary was upstairs putting her books in order one quiet afternoon when she heard the bell sound, the front door open, and a visitor arrive. She had trained herself to pay little attention to such comings and goings. Why should they concern her? And continued dutifully with her task. She was so absorbed that she did not hear Mrs. Gardiner come hurrying up the stairs, did not notice her at all until, breathing hard, her aunt burst through the door into her room.
Mary, he is here. Tom is here. Downstairs, in the drawing room.
Mary was dumbstruck. These were the words that for so long she had longed to hear. Time and time again, during dark, sleepless nights, on silent afternoons in the airless drawing room, as she walked down dusty city streets, she had imagined them being said, had wondered how they would sound, what she would feel, how she would act. And now it had actually happened. They had been said. And she sat rooted to the spot. Speechless.
Come, this won't do. He's asking for you. You must go down.
Mary saw her aunt, felt her agitation and concern, heard the anxiety in her voice. But all these things somehow seemed at a great remove from her. It was as if she stood quite apart from herself, watching her aunt, the room, her books, all from a distance. Then suddenly the shock passed. She understood, took a deep, shuddering breath, and was somehow herself again.
He is really here? He has come at last? Yes, yes, he has. And he wants to talk to you. Do please come down.
Mrs. Gardiner held out her hand, but Mary did not take it. I need a minute alone, to compose myself. Please tell him I will be there shortly. I have waited so long for him, I think he may wait a little now for me. Mrs. Gardiner looked at her imploringly.
Mary, I beg of you, do not give in to angry feelings yet. Give him a chance. Let him speak to you.
I will, but I hope he will also listen to me, and I cannot come down before I have it clear in my head exactly what I want to say. Mrs. Gardiner hesitated. But Mary was immovable. Once her aunt had gone, she sat staring blankly at her writing desk before laying her head gently against its cool, smooth surface. She could smell the faint scent of wood polish, and it occurred to her that it was not quite as pleasant as the recipe of which Charlotte Collins had been so proud. She closed her eyes and remained there motionless for a minute. Then she sat up, reached into a drawer and pulled out a small black bag. Inside, she found the Greek dictionary Mr. Collins had given her, and withdrew from its pages the single slip of paper on which she had written a few words of Greek. Happiness depends on ourselves. She looked at it intently, then folded it up and pushed it down the front of her dress. Only then did she smooth down her hair and make her way downstairs. It took a great deal of courage to walk into the drawing room. She hesitated for a moment outside the door. Then somehow she was inside, and there he was, standing at the long window, staring out into the street, a dark man in a dark jacket. Whenever she had thought of him, he had always been wearing the loose brown coat he wore on the Fells. Now here he was, in city clothes, tall and thinner than when she last saw him. When he turned towards her, she was shocked. He looked as drawn and as unhappy as she knew she did herself. Miss Bennet, I cannot tell you how pleased I am to see you again. At the sound of his voice, her self-control nearly deserted her, but she was determined not to falter. Yes, sir. It has been too long, I think. He moved towards her and was about to reply, but Mary interrupted him. I did not mean that as a mere politeness. It has been nearly 2 months since we last saw you. I know it, he answered, his voice grave. I have counted every day, every hour. He stopped, standing in the silent, sunlit drawing room, as if he would go no further towards her without some encouragement. I am here to tell you how very much I have missed you, and to discover if, as I very much hope, you may have missed me, too.
He is very brown, thought Mary, no doubt tanned by his walking. It made his eyes seem very bright in his face.
I have come to explain, Mary, if you will allow me to do so, and to ask your forgiveness. I know I do not deserve it, but I hope you will grant it anyway.
When he spoke her name, she thought she must capitulate. Give in to the desire rising up in her to let him talk and explain as much as he wished. But she made herself resist such a surrender. There were things she was resolved to say, and she would not be prevented from doing so, even by her own unruly feelings. I know it is not usual, she said, surprised at the steadiness of her voice, for a woman to put herself forward in this way, but I hope on this occasion you will allow me to speak first. I have had a great deal of time to think about what I would say if this moment were to come to pass. And now that it has, I want very much to make no mistakes. Shall we sit down?
She moved to the sofa and arranged herself there, back straight, head held high. He took his place opposite her in the chair he had so often occupied in that room and looked at her, serious, expectant.
I hope you will excuse me if I begin with a personal observation. Mary knew her words were stiff and formal, but she had chosen them carefully. She was determined not to lose her composure, and the chilly exactness of her words helped her preserve it. For as long as I can remember, I have tried to use my intellect to understand the world. I have been teased and laughed at for it, as it is not thought a very attractive quality in a woman. But when I was lonely and unhappy, as I was for much of my life, it served me well enough. She shifted in her seat. She was nervous, but she had begun and knew now she could continue. Then I met you, and everything changed. You introduced me to poetry. You showed me the beauty of the natural world. You made me laugh. You gave me warmth and kindness and affection. In short, you taught me to feel as I had never done before. He sat absolutely still, making no further attempt to speak. And I did feel, Mr. Hayward. I experienced every kind of emotion in your company. It began as friendship, but soon I began to think, I allowed myself to hope, that you felt, that you intended something more. She cast her eyes down. She wanted to continue, but was not sure she could look at him as she did so. That made me very happy. In fact, I don't think I have ever been happier. But then, up in the lakes, everything went wrong. I felt I had lost your affection, but I did not know why. The sensible thing, the rational thing, would have been to ask how I had offended you, and not to have given up until I had discovered the cause of your change of heart. But my emotions got the better of me. I was angry, confused, unhappy, and in the end, I said nothing. And neither did you.
Down in the hall, Mr. Gardiner's prized gilt clock began to strike the half hour. Its chime was very carrying, and Mary paused until it was done.
I cannot say what kept you silent. I only know I quickly began to regret my own stupid failure to speak. But by then you had gone away, and I could do nothing to put right my mistake. I was told that as a woman it was not my place to act. All I could do was wait. That is what I've been doing until this very afternoon.
Mary looked up, and their eyes met.
But I think I have done enough waiting now.
She leant forward, and the words began to spill out of her.
For I must tell you, sir, that some weeks ago I made a promise to myself that if we ever saw one another again, I would hold back no longer, but would speak, would act, no matter what the world thought of it. If you lacked the courage to declare yourself candidly, I did not. I swore I would confess my feelings to you regardless of the consequences. I would rather tell the truth and risk humiliation than pass up the chance of happiness because I was not brave enough to say honestly what I felt. Now that she had come to the point, Mary's spirits almost failed her. She could not stay where she was, but rose and stood behind the sofa, grasping its chintz back tightly with both hands, willing herself to break every rule of propriety, modesty, and good behaviour, and continue. So this is what I wish to say. I love you, Mr. Hayward. I have loved you for a very long time, and I know I will never love anyone as much as I love you. You are the only man who could ever make me happy. And I have missed you. Oh, I have missed you so very, very much.
Then her self-possession finally deserted her. Her voice broke, and a sob escaped her. And before she knew it, he was beside her, had taken her in his arms, and was holding her tight against him.
Mary, my own dearest Mary, everything you say, it is exactly what I feel. I love you, Mary, so very deeply. I am so very sorry if I hurt you. I shall never do so again. All I want is to love you as you deserve, for the rest of my life, if you will allow it.
He released her a little, just enough to look earnestly into her eyes.
I love you even more for the courage of your words, for your having found the bravery to say them. There is no one like you, so serious, so severe, so true. How could I not love you?
He stroked her hair. She lifted up her face to smile at him, and he kissed her very tenderly. For a moment they did not move, but stood together in a triumphant embrace, utterly content. She laid her head against his heart, certain it was where she belonged.
"Shall we be married, then?" he whispered in her ear. "As soon as ever we can. Will you have me as your husband, Mary?"
She thought she might die of happiness. But that is a very rare event, even when the dearest wish of one's heart has been so thoroughly and unexpectedly gratified. So for all the delight that coursed through her, she was able to make a tolerably sensible reply.
"Oh, yes, Mr. Hayward, I should be proud to be your wife. There is nothing I want more."
They gazed at each other, suffused with pleasure, as if it were impossible to imagine anything as fascinating, as magical, and as entirely and utterly satisfying as themselves and their love for each other.
"You must learn to call me Tom, you know. If we are to be married, it is entirely proper."
"Tom," she repeated quietly. It was exciting to say it, but intimate too. When she thought what it suggested, how things would be between them now, she caught her breath.
It feels a little strange at first, but I'm sure I shall come to it.
I hope so. I'm not sure I can endure being Mr. Hayward any longer to a woman I have kissed.
Really? For shame!
He leant over and kissed her again, very gently on her cheek and on her brow, before leading her to the sofa where they sat down together. Then his arm was around her, and she noticed for the first time the way his hair curled over his collar. She liked that very much, she thought. Eventually she might find the courage to run her fingers through it, but not yet.
Oh, Tom,
she felt she could say his name now.
My heart is so full. I don't know what to say, or how to describe what I feel.
There is nothing you need to say. It is I, not you, who should be explaining myself.
He removed his encircling arm and sat up, a little apart from her.
Mary, I am so grateful, so very, very thankful that you have returned my love, but I am not sure I deserve it. Nothing in my behaviour over the last months would suggest that I do. I can only imagine the pain I must have caused you. I don't know how I could have been such a fool.
He stood up and began to pace about the room.
I should like to try to account for my actions if you are prepared to listen. I can neither excuse nor justify them. I know they do not do me much credit, but I cannot leave you in ignorance as to why I acted as I did.
I must admit, she replied,
that I long to know the truth of it.
Relieved, he returned to the sofa and took up his place beside her once more. Then he began describing the origins of his fondness for her, how he had enjoyed her company from the very beginning, how their conversations on poetry had delighted him, how her presence had gradually become essential to him, the source of more and more of his happiness. He had looked forward to their meetings with ever-increasing pleasure, thought their tastes agreed perfectly, found himself happier in her company than in that of anyone else's, and in short, soon knew himself to be very seriously attached.
In truth, I knew I loved you, he confessed, but I did not know what to do about it. I was uncertain. I worried I was not grand enough to make you an offer, that I was, well, let us say, too undistinguished for you.
Mary was astonished. It was a moment before she found her voice.
But why should you think such an extraordinary thing?
Our circumstances, the circumstances of our families, they do not seem so dissimilar.
No, perhaps not. But your elder sisters, their situations are very different. Both have married very wealthy men, powerful too, in the case of Mr. Darcy. My prospects, whilst respectable, cannot compete with his. I knew I should never be able to offer you Pemberley, Mary, or even what Mrs. Bingley enjoys.
And do you seriously think I would have cared? Mary exclaimed. I am not my sisters. I have been compared to them for as long as I can remember, but I am not them, and have no wish to be. My expectations are very different, and if you had only asked me, I could have willingly, readily, eagerly told you so.
Her vehemence made Mr. Hayward smile. If I did not understand that before, I know it now. He reached out and stroked her hair. It is true I did not speak when I might have done, but I had a plan I was convinced would answer. I did not consider I had abandoned the idea of making you an offer. I imagined I had merely postponed it. From the remoter regions of the house, the voices of the gardener children were suddenly to be heard, loud, confident, excited. They must have finished their morning lessons, thought Mary. Mr. Hayward paused until they had thundered past the drawing-room door, then went on. I had reason to believe that I stood on the brink of making a great advance in my profession. You remember those two cases over which I laboured so long and hard before we went to the lakes? I knew if I won them, they would involve a great step up for me. I told myself I should wait and see how they turned out. If I was successful, I should be in a better position to speak to you as I wished. I thought I had all the time in the world, but then my old friend Will Ryder and his entourage arrived in our little circle.
Yes, replied Mary,
Nothing was quite the same after that. I thought at first Will was entirely taken up with Miss Bingley, continued Mr. Hayward. She certainly made her preference for him very plain, and sometimes it appeared as if her admiration was not unwelcome. I suppose it is difficult for any man to remain entirely indifferent to such an obvious liking. But then I began to notice how he sought you out and took pains to talk to you. He told me he often called on you here. Something about you intrigued him, and I began to wonder if you did not, well, I shan't say returned his feelings exactly, but I know he can be very winning. I did not know whether he had charmed you as he has so many others.
And again, I must ask, you did not think to speak to me directly?
I wish more than anything that I had, but I suppose I was afraid of what you might answer. I think many men lack confidence in this respect. In truth, we are not all as bold or as confident as we are supposed to be in these matters. Diffidence is far more common amongst us than is generally admitted. He looked a little shamefaced. Although I was sometimes uneasy, I did not feel able yet to act. Instead, I applied myself to my work and did all in my power to banish uncharitable ideas. My feelings for you proved far stronger than my doubts, and by the time we began our excursion to the lakes, I was in a far happier state. I had won both my cases and been given my promotion as a result. My expectations were considerably improved. I was sufficiently confident now to make you an offer and was fully resolved to ask you. There were a number of occasions when I nearly began upon it. I almost did so that day when we were drawing together. But before I settled on the right time and the right place to speak, out of the blue, Will Ryder and his party appeared once more in our company. I confess, I did not know what to make of it.
I thought you blamed me for his arrival, that you imagined I had encouraged it in some way.
I could not rid myself of the unworthy suspicion that, even if you had not actually invited him, you had hinted that his presence might not be unwelcome. It was unjust to you, I know, but I was unhappy and not thinking clearly. Then, after dinner one night at the inn, you may recall that Ryder asked to speak to me privately about his affairs. As a result of what he told me, I convinced myself I must not think about you any more.
As he spoke, Mary discovered that on the night when she had leant over the banisters, obscurely troubled as she watched the two men in intense conversation, Mr. Ryder had confided to his friend the entire story of what had passed at Rosings, describing Miss Anne de Bourgh's unsanctioned marriage, Lady Catherine's fury, her subsequent determination to disinherit her daughter and bestow instead her personal fortune upon his own surprised but grateful head. He had sought the advice of Mr. Hayward not just as a friend, but also as a lawyer, and had begged him to act on his behalf in managing the business involved in such a delicate transaction.
I felt I could not refuse such an urgent request. Ryder was anxious to find someone in whom he could place absolute trust, and on whose discretion he could entirely rely. Lady Catherine had informed him that, if the least hint of her situation were to leak out, she should reconsider her decision. I was sworn to the completest secrecy. Naturally, he described to me the contracts drawn up by her lawyers, and as a result, I knew exactly how very generously he would one day be provided for. It was an amount considerably in excess of my most optimistic expectations for myself, even after my victories at the bar. And I knew Ryder thought well of you. I decided there and then that it would be dishonourable in the extreme for me to speak to you as I had intended. If you said yes, as I very much hoped you would, I would be denying you the chance to accept any proposal Ryder might make to you, which would have placed you in a situation far more advantageous than anything I could offer.
Oh, Tom, you could not have been more mistaken. If you had offered me the choice, I would have told you how much I cared for you, that I would always choose you over any other man, no matter what their expectations. I know that now, but then I was not so sure. How was I to make clear to you what I felt? I did my best to show you how I felt by all the petty hints and signals permitted to us poor females, but it seemed to me you did not or would not see what I was trying to tell you. I began to think that I had misunderstood your feelings for me, that you only wished to push me away. I told myself that I must harden my heart against my feelings for you, that although it looked cruel, I was acting in your best interests. I argued that any hurt I caused you would not last long once Ryder had made his offer. But it was one thing to tell myself I must withdraw. It was quite another to see the confusion and disappointment on your face as I tried to do so. And it was all but unbearable to watch Ryder, as I thought, step so eagerly into the breach. That day on Scafell was almost insupportable for me. It seemed he was doing his utmost to make himself agreeable to you, and that you had begun to take notice of his efforts. I admit I was angry with you, and he was kind and appreciative. He did not seem confused about his feelings, and I will confess there was a moment when I found that consoling. I cannot blame you. But when Ryder refused to take the advice of the guide and leave before the rain arrived, when he looked to you for support and you gave it, I was so deeply wounded that I thought I could not endure it. I know. I saw. And I am sorry for it. You need not be. I had many opportunities to make things right. I did not seize them. I was blinded by my own reticence, by a misplaced sense of pride and honour. And then I made matters even worse. I thought I had the strength to give you up if I convinced myself it was for your benefit. But after Scafell, I knew I could not actually witness what in practice that must mean. It was impossible for me to stand and watch what I thought would happen next, as Ryder recommended himself to you with ever greater success. That was why I left. I wrote that letter to Mrs. Gardiner, and I fled, as quickly and as desperately as I could. It was probably the most impulsive act I have ever committed, and the most stupid. He stood up again and began to walk around the room once more. As soon as I reached Hampshire, I knew I had made the most dreadful mistake. I had given up the woman I loved best in the world. And for what? For some perverse idea of honour? What was I to do? I did not know, and so I did nothing. The very worst thing of all. I was paralysed. I dreaded each day that a letter would arrive announcing your engagement to Ryder. And when this became a torture to me, I fled again. I sought out a place where no message could find me, where I could find a little peace to put my thoughts in order and think what I must do next. I went to the Wye Valley in Hertfordshire, and I walked for a week above Tintern Abbey. At this, Mary could not help but smile. You consoled yourself amongst Mr. Wordsworth's steep and lofty cliffs. I am predictable, am I not? But the walk settled my mind and bolstered my courage. I understood I must come back into the world. I must return to London and discover what had happened. And here I am.
I could not be more glad of it, replied Mary softly. She held out her hand, inviting him to sit again beside her. This time it was he who leant his head on her shoulder.
I am so very sorry, Mary. I acted wrongly. I hope you will forgive me.
There were moments when both of us behaved irrationally, it is true, but I think we may safely say all is well now.
One last observation occurs to me, though. You said earlier I had taught you how to feel. That is very generous, but I'm not sure it is correct. I think feelings always ran very deep in you. If I did anything at all, it was merely to encourage you to reveal those feelings and not to deny them.
Even if that is true, Mary replied, it is still no small achievement, especially when those emotions have been buried so deep for so long.
Perhaps, but if I have taught you something of value, I should like you to understand what I have gained in return. From you, I have learned it is not enough simply to experience feeling. You showed me that one must find the courage to act upon it. There are times when happiness must be fought for, if we are to have any chance at all of achieving it.
She took his hand and held it in hers. I am not sure I could have expressed it better myself. I might add in my own defence that if I had loved you less, I might have ventured more. It was hard to be bold when I was only too aware of what I stood to lose. The room was warm, and they were both thrilled by their good fortune at finding themselves happier than they had ever expected to be. At that moment, there was nothing they wanted more than to sit together in loving, companionable silence. It might seem an unromantic circumstance, but in truth, there is no state that better demonstrates real firmness of affection than the ability to remain quietly comfortable together without conversation. And in such a situation of peaceful content, they remained for some time, contemplating their pleasure in each other, until Mr. Hayward recalled something suddenly to his mind. "Mary, I nearly forgot. I had so much to say to you that this completely slipped my mind." He pulled a letter from his coat pocket and looked at it as if surprised at its existence. "When I returned to London, I found a great pile of correspondence awaiting me. I sifted through it with some trepidation. I still feared coming upon the announcement of your engagement hidden amongst it all. Instead, I found this." He handed it to Mary. It was short and to the point.
"Dear Mr. Hayward, I presume on our small acquaintance to take the liberty of writing to you. It may be a breach of good manners, but I am sure that when you have absorbed the contents of this note, you will conclude the intrusion is justified. I believe it will interest you to know that yesterday I took tea with Miss Bennet. At the end of a conversation best described as very direct, she informed me that she had no wish to marry your friend and mine, Mr. Ryder, as she entertained no warm feelings for him. On the contrary, she told me she felt a deep affection only for you, whom she described as the one man she thought could ever make her happy. As she went on to declare that this was a truth of which she was not ashamed, and with which I might do as I pleased, I have had no hesitation in communicating it to you, to act upon as you see fit. Caroline Bingley."
Mary lay down the letter, amazed. "Well, I knew she was a bitter, angry woman, but I never imagined she would act in such an extraordinary manner." "Indeed. But it had a most galvanizing effect upon me. As soon as I read it, I knew my worst fears had not been realized. You were not married to Ryder. Indeed, the letter implied that you had refused his offer. And although I did not deserve it, it appeared my behaviour had not destroyed your feelings for me." He took the letter back and folded it up. "I read it late last night and came here first thing today. Such was its effect."
"But what did she hope to gain by it?" asked Mary.
"I admit I do not entirely understand her motives." "She obviously hoped her letter would prompt me to tell you what I felt for you, and once we had declared ourselves, the field would be clear for her to press home her advantage with Ryder."
"It was a very bold action," replied Mary.
"Even I am surprised that she would employ stratagems of this kind." "I cannot find it in my heart to be too angry with her," declared Mr. Hayward cheerfully. "I would have come here to find you whether she had written to me or not, but I came a little quicker and with far greater expectation of success than if she had never sent it at all. We must learn to live with the knowledge that there is the tiniest sliver of happiness we will always owe to her."
"It's an interesting philosophical question," Mary observed with a smile, "whether a good deed can be truly considered good if it is motivated by malice."
"A nice theological point," replied Mr. Hayward. "I'm not sure it matters, as long as it has delivered us such a very happy ending.
Is it very wicked of me to admit that knowing how much that would provoke Miss Bingley adds quite considerably to my pleasure?"
"It does not speak well to your morals, but your honesty does you credit." Then he took her in his arms again, and they found ways to express their happiness that required no further words from either of them.
Chapter 95. The satisfaction of the gardeners when informed of Mary and Tom's good news hardly requires description. That the two people other than their children
whom they loved best in the world, had decided to unite themselves with each other, was as pleasing to them as can be imagined. The wedding was to take place as soon as it could be arranged, no one seeing any reason for delay. The happy couple were to be married from Gracechurch Street, although both Lizzie and Jane offered to make their houses available, declaring either would be delighted to take charge of the arrangements. Mary was touched by their generosity and knew their good wishes were very sincerely meant, but she was pleased when Mr. Hayward admitted his desire was for a London ceremony. She had spent enough of her life in her sister's shadow, and as a new chapter opened for her, she had no wish to begin it once again as their pale satellite, made invisible by the brightness of their dazzle. This time, she would be the star, with all eyes for once on her. A further advantage of a city wedding was the improbability of Mrs. Bennet's being disposed to attend it. And indeed, as was expected, she wrote to Mary explaining that the state of her nerves would not permit her to make the journey. But there was, in her letter, a genuine sense of satisfaction. Against all expectations, she had achieved her life's ambition. She had lived to see every Bennet sister married, even the daughter who she was certain would never find a husband, especially after the unfortunate business of the spectacles. She did not display much interest in the gentleman himself, once she was informed of his circumstances. The mere fact of the marriage was enough to gratify her and bring forth what limited congratulations it lay within her power to give. It was not much of a blessing, but Mary was content to regard it as such. Two further letters arrived from Hertfordshire. One was from Charlotte, expressing her good wishes with a warmth more polite than heartfelt. Her two boys were well, the new baby bouncing and healthy. The house looked even neater and smarter than when Mary was there, and the rose arbour flourished mightily. Mr. Collins begged to be remembered to her. She concluded with an invitation to visit them at Longbourn, which both she and Mary knew would never be taken up. The second note gave Mary far more pleasure, because she knew the joy it expressed could not have been more sincerely felt. Mrs. Hill wrote that she had always known Mary would one day find the happiness she deserved. Had she not often told her so? And she could not be more delighted than to learn she had been right. She begged a slice of their wedding cake as a marriage favour, which Mary would not have denied her for the world. Even Mr. Ryder was generous enough to send a short but cheerful note, the briskness of which he excused by reason of its having been written in extreme haste. He was about to leave for Italy, a trip they both knew he had long meditated, and which, due to the recent improvement in his circumstances, he now felt confident enough to undertake. He did not mention a companion, but it was soon after generally known that he had been joined on his travels by Caroline Bingley, and that the two of them were now established in a villa overlooking the sea outside Genoa, living as man and wife. There was no agreement as to whether they had actually undergone the rites that entitled them to be so described. Tom was sceptical, but Mary, considering the power of Miss Bingley's will, and influenced by her own wish to see everyone as happy as she was herself, preferred to believe that Miss Bingley had achieved her heart's desire of being married to a man of wealth and position by whatever means she had considered necessary. Late one afternoon, a few weeks before their wedding, Mary found herself standing alone in an empty house in a North London square where she and Mr. Hayward were to live after they were married. She strode through its rooms, spectacles perched unashamedly on her nose, notebook in her hand, measuring, thinking, planning. Now she stood in the drawing room, looking out from the large, long windows into the gardens beneath, imagining exactly how it should be arranged. There was just enough room for all their books. She should have hers situated on this wall, with a chair next to the shelves, where she could read in the sun. Her piano should go here, and around the fireplace she would have several large sofas, positioned to encourage both comfort and conversation. She was determined this would be a convivial house, full of liveliness, laughter, and good talk. It should be as much as possible like Gracechurch Street, a place where friends would visit often, good dinners would be served, and no one would ever stand on ceremony. She should keep the tables well polished, and she would have flowers upon them whenever they could be had. She smiled to herself, as it occurred to her that for someone who had never expected to have a home of her own, her ideas about how it should be arranged were remarkably precise. A home of her own. Her heart still beat a little faster when she thought of it, but that was nothing compared to what she felt when she considered the husband with whom she would share it. She and Tom were to be married. She had found a man she loved, who loved her in return, and here, in these rooms, in this house, they would make a life together. There were moments when she asked herself, as Lizzie had once done, if she deserved to be so happy. As she ran her finger down the window shutters, she felt one of those moments creep up upon her. A shiver passed through her when she thought of how it might never have happened. But this feeling did not last long. She had gradually discovered that the best response to glorious, unexpected happiness was not to seek explanation for its appearance, but simply to embrace it and be glad. This was a new lesson, but she did not think it would take long to master. With a satisfied glance around the room, she made a final note and prepared to leave. She longed to tell Tom her thoughts for the wallpaper. This is Carla Mendonca. We hope you've enjoyed The Other Bennett Sister, a Macmillan audio production from Henry Holt and Company. This title was produced by Callum Plews. Text copyright 2020 by Janice Hadlow. Production copyright 2020 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.